find out where my voice is coming out of. Stand by.
Used to come out of your mouth.
Yeah, but there's some other piece of equipment somewhere in the house where my voice is... Ah, found it. Okay. I'm getting your feedback, as you can tell. K2RIW here. K2 Romeo India Whiskey. At the time you begin the tech net, you'll hear me. I'm Dick. You'll hear John, KC2WGB. You'll hear Paul, WS2N, our space expert. John is our man on the monitoring the Echolink path, so we know if anybody's having trouble getting through that way. Paul is going to be telling us what Rosetta has been doing. Rosetta in Philly, those beautiful spacecraft that landed on 67P, the asteroid. You'll also be hearing from Hal, K60PZ, who gives us the results of his many years of experience with all kinds of test equipment. A person signs into the TechNet, he'll be doing that in a few minutes, by giving that group of four guys your call letters, your name, and the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment for the net. You need not sign in just because you're listening. This is TechNet number 1530 of the series of TechNets that have lasted for 32 years. By now we believe somebody is listening. That doesn't have to be proven to us anymore. There are quite a few nets where people get together and you hear these great big long lists of people signing in, letting them know that they're listening. You know, we don't need that confirmed with us anymore. Let me talk. And each time I pass it over to one of you guys, try to remember to listen for all four of those beeps. It's very easy to get excited saying, hey, they're addressing me. And you grab the mic immediately, so to speak, and the machine doesn't get a chance to give the four beats and fully reset. And we run into the problem of sometimes timing out the Eastern link. This repeater is a repeater in Western Long Island, so to speak. There's an Eastern Long Island repeater on 147.375 that it's linked to, and some of the people in Eastern Long Island can only hear that one. And if we time it out, then there's great big sections of the TechNet that they don't get a chance to listen to. And they let us know about that. And they hammer us on the head with that one. Let me drop. And once in a while, we should completely drop the machine and let it go to noise to make sure that all of the echo link gets properly reset. We're probably going to be hearing from Rich K2UPS, who's probably traveling somewhere across the United States, and I'd like to hear what he's got to say. And he can only do it by way of the echo link that's got to be operating correctly. Alrighty. Enough of that jazz. Now for the time for you guys to sign in, because you do have a question or a comment. Some of the tech nets are much more interesting than the others. You almost can't blame it on the four guys. It's a function of whether or not you guys ask good questions. And the good questions are the ones that are very hard to answer. So give us those questions. K2RIW, give me your call letters and name right now.
K2FGU Mobile, and yes, name is John Juliet Oscar November.
Okay, John, now give me those call letters again. It sounded like, and I know you signed them before, but I'm on the wrong page here. It sounds like you said Foxtrot Tango United. Give me the full call, John.
Thank you very much, Dick. It's Kilowatt Delta 2 Foxtrot Queen Uniform.
Foxtrot Queen Uniform. We got you, John. And by the way, since you're mobile, you're going to be the first on the list, not the problem. Anyone else to sign in? Give me your call letters and name right now.
US2N. With a real question, and of course the space report, back to you, Dick.
KC2WGB with a question, Dick.
Now, those two very nice guys signed in very nicely, but they did it improperly. They didn't give me their names. They're supposed to give me call letters and names. Lucky for them, I know that the first guy is Paul, with a real question, and the second guy is John. Okay, having some fun with them. Alrighty. One last call. Anyone else with questions or comments, give me your call letters and name right now.
KC2MDP, Steve, and yes.
Yes.
Okay, we got Steve, MDP, and who was the other person? It sounded like blank Alpha Sierra. Who was that? signed in after Steve. Who is that person? Okay, maybe we'll pick him up later. Okay, so John, what's the latest in your neighborhood, and how's that mobile of yours working? KD2, Foxtrot, Quebec, United, K2, LAW. You got it, John.
Thank you, Dick. KD2FQU mobile. My setup is good still. I'm getting your guys very well. It's a two-part question. One is screwdriver antennas use hydraulic motion in order to push it up and down. They're used during the winter time, and should I expect anything? I have an ATOS 120 with the A2857D. And the second question is relating to FCC ruling with 5 gigahertz use of unlicensed spectrum.
Now, the screwdriver antennas that I was familiar with literally had their name because they used an electronic motor that was the mechanism out of a battery-operated screwdriver to move the pointer, so to speak, to change the loading coil so that you could go to the high end or the low end of 80 meters or switch bands and so on. I wasn't familiar with that there was a hydraulically operated version, but maybe there is, and maybe the guys listening know more about it. I guess you'd worry about the hydraulic version. What is the fluid that's the hydraulics? Does it have antifreeze? Does it freeze up in the winter? So I may be misunderstanding when you said hydraulic. So let me pass it back to you first, John, to make sure I've got it right. KD2FQU, mobile, K2RIW.
Thank you, Dick. K2RIW, KD2FQU. The reason my question is because my ATOS, I sent it back to the ASU for repair about a couple of months ago, and I remember seeing oil on the whip when at the bottom end of the whip in the rod holder. But if it's just electronically pushed from the receiver, then I just wanted to know, is there any known issues with, like, freezing up? If it gets, like, sub-zero, should the antenna be retracted when it's cold out?
I can answer that, Dick.
Hey, Fred. Let's see what Eric's got to say. KE2EJ, that mysterious voice who knows about these things, K2RIW. Is that really hydraulic, or was it the oil coming out of the screwdriver electric motor mechanism? What do you think, Eric? You got it, Eric.
K2RIW, K2EJ. Well, the ATAC 100 to 120 is. They're just motor driven with a long lead screw that runs in it. Spins the lead screw. Actually, the bottom part of the ATAC 120 where the connector is, a little board mounted on it. It takes 12 volts up the coax to run the motor, and they do a little fancy pulsing and pulse decoding to determine what direction it's going. And that antenna is not the greatest antenna in the world. It was kind of lousy on 2 meters. It's okay on 6 meters. UHF, it sort of works. But, it's a pretty reliable antenna, you know, as far as, like, if you don't have it full of water because you've had it upside down, or the outside is cracked, it's pretty reliable. But, yes, you can get ice packed in it, and it'll freeze up. Give it a whack and loosen itself up. K2RIW, K2J.
JTC with comment. Gonna pass it over to Hal in a second. Eric, the people who use the screwdriver antenna, do they usually use it simultaneously with an automatic antenna tuner? And the whole reason why you're doing that screwdriver adjustment, the motion of the motor and the gear train, is to try to re-resonate it to the frequency that you just switched to. So, I'm guessing most people use it with an automatic antenna tuner, and now if the automatic antenna tuner is doing its thing at the same time that the screwdriver motor is doing its traverse, my guess is there could be a little bit of a race problem there that can create some spooky effects. Bunch of guesses on my part, and I'll be passing it first to Eric and then Hal for comments on this. Eric first, go ahead.
Roger, Dick. Well, if you have an ATOS 120 and you're using like an 857, there ain't no antenna tuner. It's the antenna that's doing the tuning. So, no, it's kind of silly to have automatic screwdriver and automatic tuner in the radio at the same time. There are some folks that make little boxes that you can hook up to, like, your high Sierra or your target antenna that counts the number of pulses as the thing turns. It remembers where you were, so when you tune to a particular frequency and you've got a stored memory, it'll come back to where it was. So there's a lot of neat little things, but the concept of having two tuners going at the same time is kind of silly. So Yaesu decided, well, if buy my antenna, you don't need a tuner. There you go. K2RIW, getting to it, guys. KW.
Somebody KW, and you're third on the list with information on this particular item. I can see a slight need for an antenna tuner, Eric, because the primary thing you want to do when you want to make an antenna transmit, the highest of your priorities, it must resonate on your frequency. And moving that coil on the screwdriver adjustment hits you on resonance. But depending on which band you've gone to, and you just told us on 2 meters it doesn't do such a good job, the antenna may do a beautiful job of resonating on 2 meters, but maybe it's still a 2.5-to-1 standing wave ratio because the impedance match is not quite right, even though it's resonant. Just the screwdriver mechanism only has one tuning device, not two. And therefore, there might be some need for an antenna tuner. Bunch of guesses on my part. The next person on the list to tell us about this is Hal, K6DPZ. I bet you've used quite a few of these, Hal, and I bet you've seen some of the grief, so fire away. K6DPZ, K2RIW, the TechNet.
All right, W in the Tech, K6DPZ. I'm very familiar with the HS 100 and 120. First of all, the way it works, from 0 to almost 6 volts, the antenna is going to go up. The switching point is from 6 to 12, then the motor reverses and goes down. What happens in the transceiver, the 857, a few of the other ones are formed to use with the HS tuner, the transceiver has an SWR circuit. It samples the SWR, it directs the antenna to go up or down by reversing the voltage below of from 0 to 6 and 6 to 12. And the voltage is set up the line. This variable voltage. Now, the only real critical part about this whole thing, if your feed line on your HS antenna shorts, you blow a chip out in the Yaesu radios. And the sad part is, Yaesu does not have the chip. They're no longer available. I've seen about 5 sets come in already because it shorted the auto tuner, the HS tuner. And it's all great. Go ahead, pick it up, Jake. The QIW K6 DPC. I'm very familiar with repairing these things and the whole system.
Very fine, Hal. A lot of good information. However, your audio is very heavy. The rig sounds like you're a quarter of an inch away from the mic, extremely heavy on the sibilance. You're going to have to back off a little bit and remember to back off a little bit. Some people may have had a little bit of trouble understanding some of what you said. So to repeat what Hal said, 0 to 6 volts, it goes up. 6 to 12 volts, it goes back down. If there's a short circuit on that cable going to that antenna, the chip that's in the radio gets damaged and the chip is no longer available. And so it's a very sad situation. You got to make sure that your coax cable doesn't have even the slightest tendency for one little whisker of the braid to short out the center conductor of that cable, because it may give that chip in your radio that's firing the screwdriver, it may give it an awful lot of grief, if you know what I mean. So we got to be careful on that one. If this is the best of all worlds, whenever I'm running mobile, let me drop. I like to have one of my poor man's bird watt meter, I call it. Micromatch, I think is the name of the company that makes this thing that's got a needle on it, and you can flip the switch and look at forward power and reverse power. As such, when I'm running mobile, I can look at the reverse power on my antenna and find out, is the antenna properly tuned? Is the ice on the antenna giving me grief? Has something failed in the coax cable? In other words, by looking at reflected power versus forward power, by flipping that switch that's of this device sitting on the seat of the car, I know what the health of my antenna is as I'm tooling along, and I can find out if there's a sudden change in the antenna and whether or not I should do something about it. Now, there was another person who wanted to give us some information. We missed his prefix. We heard blank, blank, kilowatt, KW. Who was that? Give us your full call and your name and your information, sir. K2LIW of the TechNet.
Hi, good evening. This is Alan at 2KW. I'm not even going to get started on radios that manufacturers don't support any longer. But on the original subject of the screwdriver antenna and using it with an antenna tuner, you don't do them both at the same time. You do the screwdriver antenna first. Get the antenna tuned for resonance, which is not necessarily a one-to-one match. It's just as close to one-to-one as it can get. After the antenna is tuned to resonance, then you can use the internal antenna tuner so that the rig is looking at one-to-one, and that keeps the radio happy. But don't do them at the same time, because when the antenna is off resonance, it's not representing the same impedance that it'll be at resonance. So any adjustment that the rig's antenna tuner makes is incorrect. Over.
Alan and Hal in that order. While the antenna tuner is locked down, so to speak, and then after the antenna tuner, particularly on 2 meters, does its thing, the screwdriver does its thing, release the hold on the antenna tuner and let it do its thing. And now you can make a happier combination. That's a bunch of opinions on my part. I haven't actually owned that particular setup. Let's see what Hal's got to say on this. K6DPZ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Your
tech
goes to the cover.
Okay, K2RIW
in
TechNet, K6DPZ. Okay, let me just say two things. If you're using a radio with a built-in antenna tuner and that method, the problem you're going to have is the base impedance of the antenna tuner is not matched to your radiating feed line in the car from the radio to the so-called ATIS antenna. It's not really matched. The best way to do it, and the most sanitary way to do it, is you switch the radio. Don't use the radio's antenna tuner, first of all. That's a no-no. Go through the radio into the ATIS antenna. Get the lowest standing wave. And by utilizing a coaxial relay out where the antenna is, use a random wire tuner which will match the base impedance of the ATIS antenna. And the coax between the radio and the random wire tuner, which is mounted here in the back of the vehicle, will give you a perfect base impedance match to the ATIS antenna. And you get about a 50% increase in effective radiation. Go ahead, sir.
Q2QIQ with a comment?
Yeah, we got Eric and Glenn in that order. Yeah, that does sound like the Cadillac approach, what you've just given us, Hal. I like the sound of that for those who have got the equipment and willing to make that investment. KE2EJ, K2RIW, go ahead, Eric.
Hey, K2RIW, K2EJ, what I was going to add is that depending upon whose antenna you are using, whose screwdriver, the Yaesu versus, say, a High Sierra, the diameter of the coil is different. The Yaesu is much smaller. It's got a little finer resolution, whereas the High Sierra and the Tar Heels have a bit more spacing. So, as you said, Dick, when I've had radios with the screwdriver on it that had built-in antenna tuners, you bypass the tuner, you ask the screwdriver to do the best job it can, because you might be on a frequency that's somewhere in between the two, and don't forget you've got a set of fingers that are making contact with the coil. So, you know, it takes a jump for every step of the coil, the larger the diameter. And then after you've gotten the best WR out of your screwdriver, then you can ask the tuner to fine-tune it for you, and you can get a better match. K2RWK2J.
The good news about an automobile is that the total length of the transmission line between the transmitter and the antenna is probably rarely more than 20 feet. So if you've got a low enough loss feed line, you can tolerate quite a bit of standing wave ratio and do the antenna tuning at the transmitter. What Hal was recommending is that quite a few of us will use a small diameter coax because they want to be able to hide it under the rug and in the ceiling and upholstery and so on. As such, the cable has got a higher loss, and therefore there's a huge advantage in power output if you do the antenna tuning, the tuning, so to speak, right at the antenna. So you pay your money and you take your choice on loss of cable versus another external antenna tuner, and multiple ways to go. Glenn, that super vehicle of yours that you had that Hurricane Sandy damaged on you, I know you not only had the world's best DOP scan on there, but I bet you had a real good working screwdriver antenna. KC2 QIQ, K2RIW, go ahead, Glenn.
Good evening, Vic. Luckily for me, I didn't have the screwdriver antenna or hand gear in the car during the flood, so it did survive. I am the owner of two Tar Heel A400s, and a gray one and a black one. And not that it really makes any difference, just the powder coat finish on them. I also have an Icon 7000, and it was an additional unit that I bought in between the radio and the antenna and the Tar Heel that allows me to use the tuning function of the automatic antenna tuner on the Icon 7000, where if I hit the tune button, it actually not only finds resonance of the Tar Heel antenna, but then it does a small touch-up to make sure that the, and this is only in low power, by the way. When you hit the tune button, it puts out less than 5 watts to put the antenna into tune. It finds the resonance, and then it just tweaks the antenna a little bit back and forth just to find the perfect match for the radio, and then it releases, and you can transmit on virtually anything from 6 meters to 160 meters, KC2 QIQ.
You got a chance, I have another comment.
We're going to go back to you in a minute, Hal. But let me wait for the beeps. Wow. So you had a lot of bandwidth there, Glenn. The one thing you didn't say, but I think it's highly implied, is that in the 5-watt tuned mode, you go to all of your favorite frequencies, and that whole system, the antenna tuner, the antenna, whatever, it all finds the best possible combination. I'd like to believe that somewhere is put into memory. So the next time that you're tooling down the road and you do a QSY from one band to the other, the system knows by way of the memory how to set all of its dials. That would be the nice way. I wonder if that's approximately what you were describing there, Glenn. Sounds like quite a Cadillac you had, so to speak. KC2QIQ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
And still have, Dick. If anybody wants to see it, I could hook it up. It really doesn't take that long to connect up that rig with that tuner. And the tuner is really just an interface box. It goes between the Icon 7000 and the Tar Heel. So in other words, there's the motor cable that runs up to this little interface box, and then there's a 4-pin connector that goes back into the, and I think it runs at 9600 baud. And it basically does the digital interface between the radio and the Tar Heel motor, and it always finds perfect match on it. It's very, very nice. And yes, when you go from band to band, not interfrequency, but band to band. So in other words, let's say if I was on 80, and then I were to switch the band to 10 meters, it would basically basically wind up the antenna for 10 meters, and then you might just have to hit the tune button, but it doesn't take nearly as long. Let me let it drop for a second. The only real downside to the Tar Heel is that even though the antenna tuner and the motor inside that little screwdriver moves around pretty quickly, it still takes a long time. If you've got to go from the setting of, let's say, 160 meters and then go to 10 meters, it could take a couple of minutes for that thing to wind all the way through that big coil. Where if you just hit the band switch, it basically puts the coil into a very close position so that when you go to a band, when you switch bands, and then you want to just hit the button as a quick tune-up, it's like 1, 2, 3, and you're spot on frequency. So, but there is, when you first install the antenna, you do have to put it through a memory function and check all of the bands, at least tune one frequency on at least each one of the bands. KC2QIQ.
I'm hearing the sound of our radio equipment developing more and more artificial intelligence as time goes on. Great stuff. K6DPZ, K2RW, give us some more information on this one, Hal.
All right, W, K6DPZ. Okay, well, see, with most of these new subject to RF getting into the computer. That's why I found it's essential to make sure the feed line between the radio in the front and the antenna system is flat, and the only radiation is coming off the antenna. Because you can have a problem where the coax is not terminated, the coax will radiate, and depending on how you install the coax in the vehicle, you could get RF into some critical parts of the vehicle and expect me to create problems with the braking system, and a lot of the other systems are controlled by computers. I set up a system for somebody that ran a couple hundred watts in the mobile, and the first thing I did was, you know, use a random wire tuner all the way back in the trunk, and the set was up in the middle area of the car, and we terminated it properly where we had no radiation on that feed line, and then it went to a center-loaded antenna, not a tar heel, or a motor-driven antenna. As a matter of fact, I do a lot of exclusive bowway work myself, and I use an Australia Outbacker, but the Outbacker is basically a base-mounted antenna. And what I did, I put an extension on the Outbacker, made it center-loading, and mounted to the bottom of the car, and drive it right with an antenna tuner. And I've worked the world with this system on all bands. Go ahead, Dick.
Good information. And thank you, Hal. There's a lot to these screwdrivers and tar heels and ATOSes and mobile setups in general, particularly on 80 meters or even 160 meters, to take a wavelength that big and force the antenna to be on a mobile without mowing down all the trees in your neighborhood because the whip is so high. It's a bit of a challenge, but as you're discovering, resonance really is where it happens. The magic of radio is once that antenna is resonant, even though it's too darn small, doesn't necessarily hurt you once you get resonance and then a good impedance match beyond that. So don't give up. And there's a lot of capability here, John, even though you may hear people say negative comments about mobile operations with this kind of equipment on these frequencies. KD2FQU mobile, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Thank you very much, Dick. K2RIW in the TechNet and KD2FQU. I wanted to comment on Hal's comment. Well, a question for Hal's comment. With the antenna tuner in the back of the car, I asked about probably a couple weeks ago if a good antenna tuner for mobile use. I was told about the CH4 from Omnicom for random wire. How would that work with the ATOS 120? I understand that it has the feed line from the radio over to the antenna tuner, and then the antenna connects into the antenna tuner, and then the feed line going up to the ATOS. Well, I'm just curious, though, on the tuning properties, how would you program that antenna tuner in a similar setup?
K6TPZ, K2RIW, wait for the beeps, and you got it out.
K2RIW is K6TPZ. I didn't get the full question. There was breaking in and out. I didn't get the full question he had. If he's going to use an ATIS with an antenna tuner, though, if it's not a random wire tuner, he has to make the feed as close as possible to the ATIS antenna and the tuner. A normal antenna tuner will not match as broad the impedance as a random wire tuner like an AH4 or an STC. They can match anywhere from about 13 ohms impedance to almost 2,000 ohms impedance. And the basic impedance of a mobile antenna can wind up being very low in many instances. Go ahead, Tick.
Hey, you might want to repeat your question. We did have a fair amount of dropouts. You're going through a region with your mobile, John, where we're missing every fourth word, if you know what I mean. So please repeat your question. KD2FQU, K2RIW mobile. You know what I mean.
Thank you very much, Dick. The question is, well, of course, the AH4 is automatic. It's not automatic. It's a random wire tuner. Very good results from what I've read and heard about from Hal. But using the 857D, I know that it has tuner setting, then it has the ATOS setting. And on tuner, would you still communicate with the antenna tuner? But when the rig is set to ATOS, it would automatically adjust the ASOS antenna. So my question is, how would I match GPS first on the ASOS and then have the antenna center that H4, for instance, tune it?
Again, we had quite a few dropouts right at the end of the critical portion of the question. Let's see if Hal managed to get the question out of that. K6DPZ, K2LAW.
K2LAW, detector K6DPZ. Well, I think what he was trying to say was he first has a memory for the HTS tuner with the radio that he's using. Well, there's no problem with that. The memory would bring it into the range, null it out as far as it could go, even though there would still be a standing wave. So what he has to do is bring it in the range, null it out, use a coaxial relay to then switch the input to the H's antenna to the random wire tuner and then drive the H's antenna with that. It's a double pole type of switching circuit. And then if you key it again, then the random wire tuner would take up the difference of impedance and get the thing flat back to the radio.
Let's see if that made some sense to you, John. KD2FQU, K2RW, you got it, John.
Thank you very much, yes. Hal did answer the question, relay system. So are there... Oh, I'm not big on actually building anything right now. I just wanted to know, well then, what relays are available on the market that are compatible with a similar setup? I'm just using the ASOS right now with the 857D, and it tunes directly from the rig. So if I was to get the antenna tuner, what relay system would I be able to get in order to add into the system with that?
You were quite good until the last 1.5 sentences where you had a lot of dropouts. Please repeat the last 1.5 sentences of your question, John. Go ahead.
Thank you very much, Dick. I apologize. I'm mobile in Brooklyn now. I'm actually getting a bit of static on my side. The last bit is right now my rig is set up on, the wires ran straight over to the ASOS. And the rig is set to the ASOS setting to auto-tune. My question is, what relay is available on the market? I am not in the area to build a relay system on my own just yet. But in order to add that relay and the AH4 antenna tuner, what other components as that relay would be necessary? That's my question.
EC2QRQ with a comment?
Then take comments. I'll stand by.
Had something funny going on with my microphone. Go, Hal first, and then Glenn, and then I want to go ahead and Hal.
Okay, well, you can build the switchover system yourself. You need a double pole, double throw relay, preferably an earlier relay that's ceramic that has good contacts. And with that one relay, you're able to be able to switch from the H4 or directly into the H's. And the wiring would not be that complex to do the whole job. Go ahead.
Okay, Glenn, next. KC2QIQ, go ahead with all your suggestions, Glenn, and how you made your system work so well.
The first thing is I'd like to direct you to a website, www.n2vt.com. This is a gentleman who's been through all of this, and he produces a box for you. So in other words, when I had my Icon 7000 and I had the Tar Heel, I had to sit down with this kooky rocker switch and try to find resonance and go through all of this. And then I found out, of course, you know, that there's a tune button, and this particular gentleman made the box already with the memory built inside of it, everything else, where it detects the VSWR from the current going to the motor of the antenna. Absolute beautiful thing. It measures the VSWR, the return loss coming back from the antenna back to the transceiver. Absolute beautiful thing. And the device is actually called Turbo Tuner. It's an excellent device. It connects right to the rig, and they also make Turbo Tuner, not only for ICOM, but they make it for Kenwood. They also make it for the Yaesu radios and just about everything. And I know for sure that the High Sierras and the Tar Heels, this box will work for. But I'm pretty sure that they have something for ATAS as well, if not maybe directly. Yaesu has something very similar. KC2QIQ.
I'm at KC16,
first of all, back to Glenn. Let's make sure we got that beautiful website correctly for the turbo tuner. www.november2victortango, like Vermont, but november2victortango.com. Do I have that correct, Glenn? Go ahead.
Yes, it is, and the product that he's interested in is called Turbo Tuner. As a matter of fact, even if you just Google Turbo Tuner / Yaesu, Turbo Tuner, Kenwood, whatever it is that you wanted for, Tar Heel antennas, usually any of the sites that carry these motorized antennas typically advertise the this website and the Turbo Tuner as one of the accessories that you'd want to have. KC2QIQ.
Now, we amateurs are frugal people, Glenn, so just give us a little bit of a ballpark. Roughly how many dollars is the turbo tuner for a setup somewhat like John's? Go ahead, Glenn.
You have to excuse me, Dick. I've had a lot of happen to me in the past 2 years. Most recently pretty devastating, and I really don't have a clue right now. I mean, I can look it up for you on PC. Actually, I had to run all the way into the garage to pick up the turbo tuner box to even come up with the name and the website on it. But right now, I don't even have a ballpark for you, Dick. Sorry. KC2QIQ.
Tuner work on 6 meters.
Do you think the turbo tuner works on 6 meters, Glenn?
Yes, it does. As a matter of fact, if your antenna could tune resonance all the way up to 2 meters or 70 centimeters, it would work as well. There's no limitation. In other words, there's no... basically, what's happening is it looks for the peak and then the 50-ohm match. So in other words, when you're running the cable from the transceiver, you just have to make sure that the transceiver wiring goes from the antenna output jack into the turbo tuner and then out to the antenna. See, in other words, the only place where in some of these transceivers it could give you trouble is that the VHF-UHF connector on the back of the radio is separate from the HF. So when I use my Tar Heel, it's always wired to the HF antenna plug, but you would have to manually either with an antenna switch or unscrew the coax onto the different ports. Hopefully that answers the question. KC2QIQ.
2KW.
Okay, you gave us a lot of good information, Glenn. No apology required. We're going to go to Hal for the further information, and then Alan in that order. Hal, K60BZ, go right ahead.
K60BZ. Well, no, I'm familiar with the turbo tuner also. The thing is, you're still tuning a motor-driven coil, and you're still not going to get a perfect resonant match. It's a controller for the HS120, instead of using the controller, it's in the Yaesu radio. My method is a pure match, because once you get the Yaesu near the ballpark, there's still a base impedance mismatch. But when the AH4 is switched in, then you got a pure match on that cable with no loss at all. Go ahead.
2QIQ with a comment to that.
Okay. Well done, Hal. We understand that. We're going to go to Alan and then Glenn in that order. N2 kilowatt whiskey, K2LAW. Go ahead, Alan.
Okay. Right. Hal's absolutely right about the AH4, by the way. But the point I wanted to bring out was that the turbo tuner is manufactured by November 2 Victor Zulu. Not Victor Tango. The website is www.november2victorzulu.com.
Good information, Alan. So November 2, Victor Zulu for the turbo tuner. Well done. Glenn, KC2QIQ. Go right ahead, Glenn.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure Alan is correct about that because I've had my turbo tuner for a while, and I believe originally it was N2VT. So that's what's printed on the box. I'm looking at it in front of me. But I believe right now, because I just did a Google search for the turbo tuner, and it came up N2VZ. So if somebody's looking for it today, definitely don't use the T, use the Z. But what I was going to mention about screwdriver antennas mounting on a car and not getting with the, by adjusting the coil, getting a perfect match, I was able to do it on all bands with mine, and initially I wasn't. The lowest VSWR I could get on some bands was 2 to 1, some were 1.5 to 1, and with a little bit of experimentation and grounding efforts, I found out that what was happening was that the supports that mount the base of these antennas were not properly grounded, and I've been able to get perfect match on every screwdriver antenna, whether it be the NTAS or the High Sierras or these Tar Heels, any one of them, getting perfect matches on them without external antenna tuners by strictly fixing the ground on the return. If you get the ground correct, and that can be done on during setup. Let me let it drop. The way to do this is that if you're going to set one of these up properly, you attach the mount to the car, and then what you want to do is get something like one of the VSWR sensing devices, like the MFJ, antenna analyzer, and just basically swing along and find out how good the matches are on different bands. And if you're not getting a low enough dip, go back and get some really nice thick copper braid underneath there, and start making attachments between the base grounding return of that antenna to underneath the body, the chassis somewhere, and get a nice hefty ground. And some people are like, oh my goodness, but the braid is now is like 3-4 feet to get to a piece of the chassis where I can really bolt it down good. In the HF frequencies, you know, from 6 meters and below, even a 4 or 5 foot piece of braid is not going to be much of a problem in grounding. Yeah, RF grounding is what I'm talking about, Dick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Well done, Glenn. Lots of good information here. As you can tell, John, you've asked an extremely good question tonight because a number of people are sitting on the threshold of should they go through the rigmarole of trying to make really good HF setup, HF slash VHF setup from my mobile in the screwdriver approach. And so we're finding out an awful lot of the details. I know you've got another question with reference to 5 gigs in the FCC. I'm going to try to ask you to bypass that for now because we've got three other people lined up. And if you want some more fills on the Tar Heel or slash screwdriver-like antenna, go right ahead, John. KD2FQU Mobile, K2RIW.
It's K6DC. I have one last comment I'd like to make before I'm out of this one.
Go ahead, Hal.
Okay. I found one of the most efficient mobile antenna systems. I've done mobile since I was 16 years old. Is use the Hustler antennas with the separate coils. Use an AH4 antenna tuner at the base of the mount. And go into your rig, and you'll work the world. That's my only comment. K6DP7.
Okay, there's the voice of experience. Have at least one good way of doing it. KD2FQU, K2RIW Mobile. You're the mobile. Go ahead, John.
Thank you very much, K2RIW. This is KD2FQU. I'm stationary right now, just to actually hear everything that's going on. I really do appreciate all that information. I'm not sure how much the Tar Heels are, but I am going to look into all the information for the turbo tuner, the AH4, which I'm looking into hopefully over Christmas when the prices drop a little bit. HRO's definitely got a good price on that right now. And the wiring. So I really do appreciate the information. I will bypass that question. I'll probably ask it next week. But thank you very much, guys. This is KD2FQ. Back to you next.
2KW. Okay, don't go away yet, John. Go ahead, Alan.
I didn't realize that this wasn't an existing system. That this was a plan for a future purchase. So you probably saved yourself some money. The AH4 is a wonderful piece of equipment, but you know, for a screwdriver antenna, if you have an AH4, you can whip from Radio Shack. The AH4 will match it down to 40 meters. If you want to work 80, carry another 22 feet of wire with an alligator clip on it, throw it over a tree limb, and get on 80 with the AH4, the 102-inch stainless steel
KWFQ.com and go to N2KW. You'll see some nice antenna experiments he does. So as I see it, John, you're going to be doing quite a bit of research, experiments, tinkering, and whatever. Please come back and tell us what worked, how well it worked, even if it didn't work. Come back and let us know how your project progresses. That's a good one. Well, the next guy on our list was Paul with a real question. At the West2N, somebody, we don't know who he is, but he apparently got some kind of a question. Go ahead, Paul. K2RIW, the TechNet.
Real good, Dick.
This
is WS2N. This has to do with batteries, lithium polymer batteries. They're in almost every gadget you can think of today. You know, your cell phones, your tablets. I was wondering about the charging system on these things, the way they have it designed today. Particularly the tablet. Like, I have one here that's 4,000 milliamp hours, I think it is. And there's a belief that you should always unplug this the batteries when you get up to 100%. But I wonder if that's really that true. You know, I know there's a lot of stories that were created years ago with the NiCad batteries and the memories and this and that. And I'm just wondering if that was, this is really a holdover. You know, people plug these things in, they go to sleep at night, and the next day they'll unplug it, maybe it'll run 4, 5, 6, 10 hours after it's supposed to. And they say that, you know, when you call up the company, they say you should really unplug it. I do anyway, by the way, you know, it's a habit, but they say you should unplug the batteries. You'll shorten the life. What do you think on the lithium polymer in particular, Dick? Back to you.
Yeah, light pole batteries, lithium polymer, are becoming extremely popular. Very high energy density, very compact, lots of steam. That's the good news. But they've got a couple of quirks that have got to be honored. You don't want to discharge them below a certain critical voltage. And I'm not sure exactly what the voltage is. In the case of charging them, there's a profile of current and voltage versus time that's supposed to be supplied to the battery during charging. And this is the best of all worlds. You're using a very intelligent charger, not just a dumb voltage generator or a current generator. For the people who make the most heavy use of light bulb batteries, the guys who run electrically powered radio controlled model airplanes, they are always being strongly advised to put their battery under charge into a fireproof container. Because in the worst case, if the battery does go into a failure mode, particularly if somebody stabs the case, or if it does become overcharged to where it develops an internal pressure, a lithium polymer battery is capable of outgassing some very toxic stuff, creating smoke and flames, and literally burn things down in the worst case. So if your battery charger is intelligent enough, it knows when the batteries come up to the right amount of charge. Let me drop it. Goes into the right kind of a trickle type, topping off type of mode if the battery charger is smart enough. You take a company like Texas Instruments, a very smart company most of the time, but when it comes to the nickel cadmium batteries that used to be in their handheld calculators, oh boy, they had a charger that would cook the living daylights out of those batteries, overcharge the daylights out of them, make them super hot, and shorten the life something fierce. So even very high quality brand companies occasionally in the past have made some dumb choices. Hewlett Packard, by comparison, on their calculator had a 3-wire charger instead of a 2-wire charger on their HP 35 and 45 series, and that was an intelligent charger that did the right thing, that didn't cook the NiCads. So of you guys who have used light pole batteries, lithium polymer batteries, what experience have you had, good or bad, with chargers and leaving the battery on overnight, so to speak? Give us your call letters right now. K2RIW in the TechNet.
K2ZMB.
KB2IQN.
Victor Echo 3 here.
Okay, we got three guys there. K2ZMB, some guy, KB2IQN, never heard of him. His name is Chris. And Victor Echo 3. We'll pick you up all in that order. K K2ZMB, start up first. Put your name, sir, and then tell us what you know.
Name here is Justin. I'm one of those guys that uses the lithium polymer batteries in the radio control hobbies. And the chargers in that realm of the world tend to be very intelligent, probably even more intelligent than in many of the other devices you might see the lithium batteries in. Our chargers tend to not only know when the battery is full and go to a slow top off the battery method. I'm going to drop down here for a second. They then will compare the voltage between the individual cells, because there's usually a small low current tap on all the individual cells, and in that low current finishing charge stage, they're actually balancing one cell to the other, bringing them all to a perfectly even state of charge based on the voltage they're at, so that they will more evenly discharge to extend the life of those individual cells and hence the battery pack. Indeed, there is quite a risk of, if these batteries are abused severely, then bursting into flames. I've seen remote control aircraft have an impact with the ground and burst into flames as the casing of the battery pack was ruptured.
Boy, that is a lot of good information there, Justin. I'm just suddenly remembering now, on three occasions in my life, I have dropped a handy-talky from the 100-foot level of a tower. On three occasions, I've done that over the last 40 years. And if that was a lithium polymer battery being dropped from 100 feet, I can see that how the situation would have been considerably more terrible. And as Christopher, KB2IQN, and I have been studying radio-controlled model airplanes, we are amazed about that fancy connector that's on those batteries, so that the charging network has the ability of looking at the voltage on each and every one of the cells that are in series to make sure that they're all being charged properly. And so I'd like to believe that the lithium polymer batteries that we're using on our equipment is using some of that same smarts. If it's not there now, it's going to be there in the future, because you and I are going to be voting with our pocketbook, with our wallet, and we make sure that they do it the right way, if you know what I mean. If you've got more than one cell in series, let me drop. You just dumbly leave those cells in series, like we've done for years on nickel-cadmium batteries, and all of a sudden some of the cells become weaker than the others, and they're not being properly charged because there isn't a charge-sharing intelligent equipment on the charger for the cells that you're using, if you know what I mean. And without that intervention that the radio control model airplane people have discovered, without that, we're going to be suffering. So there's more to this story that Paul is bringing to our attention. Let's see what Chris has got to say about all this. KB2IQN, mobile. K2LIW in the TechNet.
KB2AVU.
KB2IQN.
Okay, I've got a bunch of things to touch on here. Okay, so when it comes to charging the batteries for lithium-ion polymer for devices like your iPad, your iPod, your iPhone, you know, your Android device, whatever it may be, I actually don't focus on the charger itself. What I personally focus on is making sure that the battery charge doesn't remain very long at either 100% or at 0%. Because if you leave a lithium-ion polymer battery at 100% charge, it tends to let the lithium polymer crystallize, and then it comes out of solution and you lose capacity. If you leave the battery at 0%, you have a similar kind of problem where the battery gets damaged and loses capacity. The storage charge level is typically around 40% for lithium-ion polymer. This is something else that is very common for the electric aircraft. And when it comes to electric aircraft, by the way, they don't charge the battery packs via the two-wire method at any time. They use the balance charge. There's two separate connectors for the lithium-ion polymer batteries in most cases, except for the single cell. All multi-cell packs have a balanced charge set of leads, and the only thing that the two leads that normally go to the motors and so forth are used for balance charging is for discharging overcharged cells. Back to net, KB2IQN.
As you guys are discovering, each new battery technology that we start using in our portable equipment has its individual advantages, disadvantages, and quirks. In the case of lithium polymer, don't discharge beyond a certain point, you're doing damage. If you're going to store it on the shelf for, let's say, 2 weeks, don't leave it at 100% charge. It doesn't like that. For very long periods, they saw it's something like 40% charge for very long charge periods, and now you get the maximum life out of your cells. Although these are a whole bunch of crazy things you got to obey, it's worth the effort because you're getting a hell of a lot more milliampere hours per pound and per cubic inch, if you know what I mean. So we have to look in to make sure our chargers are smart enough, that we're doing it right. There's a few more things to worry about here. I know of Victor Echo 3 signed in. I'm guessing it could have been Jim, J-I-W, or Scott, Z-T-Z. He's going to tell us who it was. Victor Echo 3, question mark. K2RIW, go right ahead, sir.
KC2QIQ with a comment on the subject.
You're on the list.
Hi there, it's Victor Echo 3, X-Ray Sierra Hotel. Just wondering if my signal is coming through okay.
Bet. Julian, you sound beautiful. X-Ray Sierra Hotel, go right ahead, Julian. Tell us what you know on this subject.
Okay, great. Yeah, name is Christian here in Toronto, actually. And, yeah, I had a funny incident last winter. We had some helicopter crew guys come out and shoot on a ski property, and one of the guys had his charger set up in a big pelican case, and I suppose he wasn't getting very good ventilation into that pelican case because everything was packed into a plastic case. And so that thing caught on fire, and the flame was about 5 feet tall. You know, because he had about a pound of lithium-ion batteries in there, and they burned like kerosene. We found out later that some of the other guys on site were using Kevlar sleeves, and that's what you're supposed to do now, is basically only charge those batteries while they're encased in a Kevlar sleeve-type compartment.
ABU. ABU, you're on the list, just in front of KIQ. Christian, we've watched, Christopher and I have watched radio control model airplane flyers use these fireproof pouch, I'm going to call it, which you pack the battery in while you're doing the charging in order to protect from that particular situation. And I'm a little bit worried about whether or not some of these safety features are being put into the amateur radio equipment that's starting to now get lithium polymer batteries. Mr. AVU, give us your full call. Give us your name, and then your information too. AVU, K2RIW, the TechNet.
Good evening to you, Dick, and good evening to the net. This is Kilo Delta 2 Alpha Victor Uniform. My name is Tim. And I got some information on the lithium ion battery. Actually, the LiPo battery being one of the lithium ion battery, and the other one is the lithium ion phosphate battery. It's called LiFe, LiFePO4, LiFe battery. So this kind of battery is much safer. I've seen some crazy YouTube test, stress test, destruction test of the battery. They shoot the battery with the pistol, they dash short the battery, and they put the battery into the fire. The battery will give out a lot of smoke, but it will never explode or caught on fire. So that's another kind of lithium ion battery. People should look at, actually the Tesla car, they use the same kind of battery, I believe. It is back to the net.
Thank you, Christian. Good stuff. Yeah, Christopher and I were hearing about the iron type of lithium polymer battery, lithium ion batteries.